name is Nancy Hanway, and I am on the International and Domestic Program Committee, which is a committee of faculty and students at Gustavus that has spearheaded the Global Insight Program. And that's a program in which, as you all know, every year a new country or global theme is focused on campus-wide in classes and with activity. And this event is really to kick off Global Insight Program. The focus is China this year. And the point of the teaching is really to take advantage of all the information, the knowledge base we have on campus, that is your professors. And so we're going to start with Dr. Henry Hayes, who is going to talk about China and economic powerhouse. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to see so many of you here. China was certainly a good choice for the first country in the Global Insight because there's no country that has impacted America and Americans more than China has in recent years. And so an excellent choice. Back there, I have a handout. If you didn't get one, you might go back. There's still a stack of them there. And I'm going to use a handout here because, for one thing, I'm limited to 20 minutes, and secondly, I'm going to use some statistics, and I want you to be able to study these statistics a little bit and ponder these statistics a little bit because some of them are a bit overwhelming. And I have also attached to the handout something called China at a Glance. I won't really be talking much to that, but I did it so that some of you may be able to use it as information. It's just two pages of pretty good data on China called China at a Glance. Also, at the very end of the second page, I cite a book that I think is very good. If you want to increase your knowledge of China, it's called China Incorporated, How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World by Ted Fishman. And it's a 2006 publication. It's a good read. In January of 81, I was fortunate enough to be able to take a January term group of students to the People's Republic of China. And the purpose of our trip was to study how people go about making their living, and to get into as many communes and as many factories and cottage industries and the things as we could possibly get into. We traveled during the month we were there from Beijing to Xi'an and from Shanghai to Guangzhou. And what we saw then is very different than what you see now. It's really hard to believe that in 25 years' time, a nation could transform itself the way China has transformed itself. And the timing of our trip was very interesting because 1980, you may remember, was just after China began to open up to the outside world. And in fact, it was in 1979 that Deng Xiaoping declared, "To get rich is glorious." And at the time he did that, China was nearing 1 billion people. They were struggling to feed their people, and things weren't going very well. And that was the beginning then of the Chinese transition. That was the beginning of this 25-year period where China has really transformed itself. And if we look at that situation and think about the situation that China was in, population nearing 1 billion people, population growing rapidly at approximately 2.6%, not able to feed itself. They had to do something. With the population growth rate that they had, they would have doubled their population in approximately 25 years. So they were looking at the possibility of having almost 2 billion people to feed and to take care of in another 25 years, which that would be about now, or about 2010. Well, this declaration, to get rich was glorious, was the beginning of the transition of China from a communist, centrally planned economy to a capitalist or a market-oriented economy. Now, Deng preferred to call it socialism with Chinese characteristics. He didn't want to admit that it was a market economy or that it was capitalism. He said it was socialism with Chinese characteristics. Nevertheless, it was the beginning of a big transition in China and for the Chinese economy. And there were two key components that happened almost immediately. The first one was, you're familiar with, the one family, one child policy. They decided that they had to implement a population control policy where they could decrease the population growth rate. And as a matter of fact, today that population growth rate has decreased down to 0.6%. So they succeeded in drastically decreasing the population growth rate. But the other thing that they did was to begin to experiment with markets. And they decided that they would start this in the agriculture sector, because that's where they were having the most difficulty. They were having difficulty feeding their people. And so what they did was they created what they called the farmers' free markets. And they said, well, in the communes, you're going to continue to work for the government, but we're going to give you some possibilities of some plots of land. We're going to give you the opportunity to do things on your own, to sew clothes, do different kinds of things, and we're going to let you create farmers' free markets. I have slides of those markets because we were there 2 years after this started. These markets just exploded. All kinds of things being brought into the markets. I remember interviewing one young woman that had acquired a pedal sewing machine. And she was, in all of her spare time, making clothes. And then on market days, she would take the clothes to market and sell them. And all of a sudden, more and more crops began to appear in the markets. And so what happened there was we had a tremendous increase in the agriculture production. And it was the beginning then of this transition. This worked so well that the leader said, well, now let's move to some cottage industry, to light manufacturing, to retail, to wholesale, and to where the point is today, they have pretty much moved to the market for everything except heavy industry, transportation. As you saw in the Olympics, the sports industry, the sports complex is still highly controlled by the government and supported by the government. And some banking, although banking is on its way to being privatized and opened up to the rest of the world. Well, this transition then moved China into being a major player in the global economy. They began to take advantage of all the people they had, the cheap labor, and they began to manufacture all kinds of different goods. And as a consequence, they have been growing faster than any country has ever grown in the world. When we were there, all you saw on the streets were bicycles back in 1980. Occasionally you'd see a bus, but mostly bicycles. Today, more than 1,000 cars a day are added to just Beijing to what's going on in China. Now for some stats. The economy has grown about 10% annually for the last 20 years. To give you some idea what that means, in the United States, our goal is to achieve 3 to 3.5% growth rate. They have grown at 10% over the past 20 years. What this means is that their economy is doubling in size. Their pie, economists call this GDP, gross domestic product. Their economy, I call it the pie, the pie of goods and services is doubling every 7 years. Think about the size. Think about what that means. Consequently, China has moved into being the second largest economy in the world, even above Japan if you use purchasing power parity to measure the conversion. In addition, as a result of this growth, they have lifted more than 300 million of their people out of poverty. Think about that. Think about those numbers. 300 million people. That's the size of the United States. That's the size of the population of the United States. The Made in China label means that the most feared words for all producers around the world is what is the China price? What is China going to be able to produce it for? And all nations are having to compete with China. Now, what's happened here in terms of the tremendous increase in production in China has resulted in increased trade. The United States has benefited from this because we have received a lot more cheaper products than we would have otherwise. China's benefited because they've received our imports. They've been able to sell to us. And the world as a whole has benefited because it has increased resource use efficiency and it has increased world output. Trade does create an increased world output. It's not a zero-sum game. Consequently, China is becoming the most powerful economy in the world. Most estimates are for China to overtake the United States in 15 to 25 years, depending on which conversion you use for GDP, but 15 to 25 years, that's not so far away. For some of you, you probably think that's an eternity, but I can tell you for some of us in here, it's not. That's not very far off. And Jeffrey Sachs has estimated that by 2050, China's economy will be 75% larger than the US economy. Okay, some of the statistics that I wanted you to think about and ponder. Let's look at why this is going to be so. In economics, size counts. This is because the success of any economy really depends upon its people and their ingenuity. Its people and what they're able to achieve. Its people and what they're able to do. And resources are important, but people and people's ability to use those resources is what really makes the difference. So let's look at some more stats. China has a population of a little over 1.3 billion people. The US's population is a little over 300 million. That means China's population in terms of people is four times the US. So if economy is really a function of its people and its ingenuity, you can begin to see where this is going. Furthermore, out of that population, China has a 800 million people workforce. 800 million people in the workforce. In the US, we have barely 160 billion. That tells you that as China begins to develop further and further and move into higher-end products, they're really going to be very, very competitive, and the size of their pie is going to continue to increase quite rapidly. One of the startling statistics that I hadn't thought about that I read in this last week's Economist magazine is that China's labor force is twice the size of the US, the EU, and Japan combined. Think about that. Twice the size of the US, the EU, and Japan combined. This says that China is indisputably going to increase the size of that pie and going to become more and more powerful because of the size of their economy. Just a few other things in the way of statistics. China saves more than 40% of its output. More than 40% of the GDP. In the US, we barely say 17%, and most of that comes from businesses because we as consumers aren't hardly saving anything. In fact, last year we creeped back into the positive category, but for the previous 2 years, we had negative savings rate from a people standpoint, from a consumer standpoint, from a household standpoint, meaning we were consuming more than we made. We're doing that, of course, by borrowing, running up our credit cards and our debt and so forth. Well, what's the significance of China saving 40% of its output? Well, it's these savings that ultimately creates investment in the economy, that ultimately creates investment in capital goods in the economy to increase China's capacity to produce. And so the savings rate is important because not only does it increase the capacity, but it also helps to increase the productivity of the Chinese economy. Now, when I say productivity, I'm not talking about production. I'm talking about the ratio of outputs to inputs. In other words, getting more and more out of the same or fewer inputs. increasing the productivity. If you, as you move from being a first-year student to a second-year student, your productivity, I'm sure, increases. You're able to do a better job of studying for exams. You're more productive. Well, this productivity is what really results in increased standard of living in any economy. I throw this in. China helped pay for some of your tax stimulus rebate last spring. China is helping pay for our trade deficit. I'm going to talk about it in a minute, and I only have a few minutes left. U.S. government gave us a tax rebate. They didn't have the money. They had to borrow the money. So what do? They sell securities. They sell bonds. Who bought the bonds? China bought a lot of them. A lot of China's savings is going into our economy. The reason we can run such a huge trade deficit in our balance of trade is that on the capital side of the ledger, countries like China and Saudi Arabia are investing in the U.S. So the capital inflow is balancing our trade outflow, and it's China that's mostly responsible for that. The bottom line here is that a larger number of people times what each people produces is going to yield a much larger GDP. And that larger GDP is going to give China the ability to do all kinds of things, and Richard's going to talk about politics in a little bit. It enhances their political position, it enhances their position in the world, but it also enhances their ability to compete with other nations on the economic landscape. One of the things that is worrisome, here's the June Business Week, it says, can the U.S. bring back the jobs from China? One of the things that's worrisome for us, and even for college graduates, is all the things that China's doing. They started out first producing clothes and shoes and toys and rather low-level type things. And then they moved to consumer electronics, TVs, DVDs, and things of this nature. Now they're getting into biotechnology and into computers and into robots, into surgery. Have you heard about surgery robots? You swallow the robot and it does some surgery on you. Getting into all kinds of things like this. This shows us that comparative advantage is dynamic. What that means is that it keeps changing. China's begin to worry because they're losing some of their clothes and shoe manufacturing to Vietnam and to Bangladesh and to some other, Thailand and some other countries. Well, what does all this mean for the U.S.? Obviously, I've tried to paint in the very little time that I have here a picture of what's happened in China with this transition. What does it mean for us in the U.S.? Well, it means that it's going to get tougher and tougher. It's going to get tougher and tougher for you guys to get the kind of jobs that you want when you graduate. It's going to get tougher and tougher for us to compete in this globalized world. And so what does that mean? What do we have to do? We have to try to take advantage of the opportunities that we have. And I've listed a few things here, and I quickly run through those. We've got to try to stay at the cutting edge of innovation. To do that requires a lot of investment in technology, a lot of investment in research and development, a lot of investment in education. Sadly, we're not doing what we should be doing as a nation, in my opinion, with respect to investment in those areas. Partly because we have such meager savings. If we were saving 40% of our GDP as China's doing, we'd have a lot more capability to put resources into technology, into the kinds of things that's going to increase productivity. It's the increase in productivity that enables us to achieve a higher standard of living. There's a whole list of things here. Develop an energy plan that relies less on foreign oil. We got to do that to decrease the outflow of dollars to the rest of the world. That's killing us. The value of the dollar is going like this. That can't continue. Increase domestic savings. I've already mentioned that. So we don't have to rely so much on China, Saudi Arabia, and other oil countries. Restore fiscal discipline to the federal government. This morning on the news, $407 billion. Federal budget deficit for this current fiscal year. Next year it's projected to be over $500 billion. We're having to come up and borrow $2 billion a day just to figure out how to finance our deficit and our debt. I wish I had more time to say something more about that. Finally, I painted a really neat picture of China. There are problems in China, and some of those problems are serious problems. All of you know about the environmental issues. You heard about that in the Olympics. China's income inequality has increased drastically since they moved towards to get rich is glorious, since they moved towards the capitalist model. It's gone from being way below the U.S. to actually being above the U.S. in terms of income inequality. That's an issue. China still has a large number of poor people in the rural areas. This is a divisive issue that is worrying the leaders of China because they don't know quite how to bring about what's happening in the rural areas, how to bring about a higher standard of living in the rural areas. Finally, the agriculture sector is not keeping up with the needs of the food that's needed. Minnesota is a beneficiary of that because we're shipping lots of beans and corn to China as a result of that. But China has to improve the productivity in the agriculture sector in order to enable more people to be transferred out of that agriculture sector into the industrial sector to keep their growth rate going. Most economists estimate that they got about another 10 years of cheap labor and of this kind of growth. And then it'll begin to level off because their economy will begin to mature and be more like ours. I promised that I'd save time for questions. I maybe have time for one question. I did start late, you know.
Yeah, oh, did, okay.
One question. Anybody? Yes. That's correct. There's a lot of places that's not farmable, and in fact, they've tried to farm a lot of the slopes and the mountains and the hills that they shouldn't have been farming, and it's caused lots of environmental issues, and the government has cracked down on that. China has a disadvantage from a resource endowment standpoint, a geographic climate standpoint, with respect to agriculture, compared to, say, the United States. So, yeah, that's very true, and it's an issue. But the biggest issue in China, if I could just say this, is that in China, the land is still state-owned. The government's still hanging on to this. They lease it to farmers, they increased it from 15 to 30 years, but the land is still state-owned. The problem is then that farmers aren't able to use it as collateral to borrow money, to exert capital or inject capital into agriculture, and consequently, after they went to the farmers' free markets, agriculture went this way, but now it's leveled off, and they've hit a plateau, and they've got big problems there. They're gonna have to do something to figure out a mechanism to inject capital into agriculture to increase the productivity in agriculture so that they can transfer more of those people into the industrial sector and also come near feeding. So thank you.
I just have one more question, though. At what point will the environmental damage destroy the economy? It seems like it's getting there.
Well, that's a huge issue, and China, you know, they subscribe to profits equal total revenue minus total cost. So they want to keep the total cost low so they could get a large part of the world market. So they intentionally didn't do the environmental stuff that they could have done.
Right.
And now it's catching up with them, and they realize it, and they're starting to do things that's going to improve it. It's not too late.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too late. We did the same thing. It wasn't until 68 that we created the Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
So it's not too late, but it's late. But I think that they understand. They recently just shut down the largest steel factory in the country and said no more.
Wow. Well, that's good. Yeah, things are. Thank you. It was great. It was really great. No,
I'm good in 20 minutes.
I'm amazed, actually. Really wonderful. Thank you so much.